Outcast. Ryan Jacobs.
This is interesting that you're saying that these kind of architectures are driven more by the users than say maybe some of the other factors that have driven us in the past.
The innovation always comes from the consumer end, the user end. It comes around from phones, it's come around from the original PC, was very much a user-based device, was a consumer-based device.
Yeah, you know, I think he has a point there. Remembering way back, you know, in the mid-80s when I sat down to my very first IBM PC XT, and with its whopping 10-megabyte hard drive. Okay, I know some of you guys are older than that, okay, and you could talk about what you did before, but, you know, I don't think they anticipated the impact that a PC would have on business computing and on the enterprise. Very, very interesting. I wonder what kind of impact the things that are going on in the so-called Web 2.0 space will have on the way we think about enterprise computing in the future. Well, that's what we're going to contemplate here on this second half of this webcast with Mike Platt. Let's go to the studios now and listen in to the webcast already in progress. Okay, so given that, that's a good transition point. So this feels like now we're going to move into sort of the second half of this whole discussion, which is really now where we begin to consider the architectural ramifications of this whole change that's happening.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is about service-oriented architecture, and there's just a couple of slides in here which you can probably skip over, which talk about, the services, web services, running on different platforms, the entity, the activity process services. This is all very well-known stuff around service-oriented architecture. So on the enterprise side, we've seen a little bit of what's happening in the consumer space and on the customer side, and we know to a great extent what's happening in the enterprise with web services. The question is, how do these things come together, right? Is Web 2.0 going to supersede SOA? Is SOA going to supersede Web 2.0? Are they both just buzzwords, whatever, And I think that probably what we're seeing is that the service-oriented architecture is there. It's an important element and will continue forward, and web services will continue forward. And there will be web services on the client as well. But we'll actually see a whole load of new elements coming in from the Web 2.0 space, and we will see what's happening in the enterprise space continuing, but we'll see this very fast change in the consumer space. And so you'll see we now have two architectures. We have a Web 2.0-based architecture, and we have a enterprise architecture. And how do these things come together? And that's what this talk's about, is what's the architecture that pulls these two things together? And we're calling that edge. And the characteristics, as you can see, when you look at them, you have a set of characteristics for the consumer side, and you have a set of characteristics for the enterprise. I think a couple of the important things to pull out of this slide is that the things that are happening on the consumer side are just huge. I mean, the power and the demand and the number of devices in the enterprise are large, obviously. But if you compare them with the amount that are actually in the consumer on people's desktops and people's phones in people's pockets, it is absolutely huge. Much, much larger by many, many scale factors than what's happening, than the number of devices and the power and the demand that we have in the enterprise. And the other interesting thing is you think, if you've got this very much larger number of devices out there and number of users out there, then they're going to be much slower to change. And typically we think of something very large as very difficult to change, like Microsoft or whatever. But actually that's not true. What we're actually seeing is that the change in the consumer space is much, much faster than we see in the enterprise space. New phone technologies, bandwidth demand, these new applications coming on stream, it happens much, much faster in the consumer space than it does in the enterprise space.
Oh, yeah, it's like I want to get a new phone every year, can you see it? Because they got a better one, a better thing,
Yeah, and that really makes, trying to bring these two things together is actually quite difficult simply because the rates of change in the two areas are so diametrically different. So you can see that there are these two different areas, very strong areas going on out there. And we will see a lot of what's happening in the consumer space starting to fold into the enterprise space. And we start to think, okay, what is it that joins these two things up? And I think if you go on to the next slide, I start talking about what joins them together. And these are what are the common capabilities between the two spaces. And these come down to four elements: relationships and relationship management. You know, we understand security and we understand identity to a great extent. But identity, just saying, okay, this is who I am, and having an info card, for instance, is fine. But that's not adequate, because you need to, you don't just want to know who I am and can I log on to the system. You want to say, well, I've logged on to the system and I've got some photos, I've got some movies, I've got a podcast, and I want to share that particular set of photos. They're my family, so I want to share them with my family. And maybe I want some photos to be shared with my friends, and maybe I belong to some club and I want a set of friends in the club who I want to share different photos with. Oh, and by the way, I then got work, and I got my work colleagues, and I want stuff I want to share with them. So we have this much richer space around relationships than just identity. You know, we want to be able to say who we are, but then we also want to say who other people are and what our relationships are with those other people. And we'll see the requirements in that space growing quite dramatically, and the support for that sort of activity going on. So that's what I mean by relationships.
So, you know, what's interesting about that, I've been thinking in the background about, well, you know, take a traditional businesses like a bank maybe, and what does a bank care about all of this? I mean, they're not going to be providing a feed for mashups or something, or maybe they might. I don't know, but it would be interesting to think about what kind of things a bank could do. But this, you hit on something there that I think might matter, in particular with a bank. Like, so for example, one of the challenges that that we have is that my wife and I have a number of accounts at different places, and but typically they have one username and password that's associated with that account, right? And so I know all of those. She doesn't know them. If I get hit by a bus tomorrow, we're in big trouble, because she probably won't know that. She'll have to figure and then get them all reset and figure it all out. But even just something as simple as that, about the relationships between, there's a group of people who could be associated with this. And for the bank to work with us, recognizing that, instead of forcing us to work with them on their terms.
Yeah, totally. Certainly the relationship side of things is one of the first things we're going to see the enterprise pick up on, because this whole ability for enterprises to understand the relationships in their customers is very important. You know, it's again, to a certain extent, if you go and have a look at what Amazon's doing today, in Amazon you can put a review up about a book, and then you can actually have a list. You can say, I've got a list of all the following books, right? And then you start getting into the I respect this guy. I think he's got a good list of things to go and have a look at. So I'm going to put him into my list of people that I want to, you know, I want to see the feed from RSS. You know, he's the person I know, and I want to include him in this sort of virtual club. So you can see how people can start to build on top of eBay. Again, eBay is very, when you look at it, has a very strong relationship management systems in there, because you have this concept of you're a good eBayer, you know, mm-hmm. i.e. you've got votes. So you'll be able to have votes that improve your trust level. So a lot of relationships about trust. How do you find trust? You find trust through people doing good things over time, and you can then build that into these systems. So again, you'll see a lot of the trust elements being built into these.
Well, and what's interesting about that is, you know, in the past, a company might have hired an editor or some kind of a person to give recommendations for books and, you know, give a list of things. And, you know, this editor may or may not be any good, but you paid money for it and you had to, all of that, right? And so what they've essentially done is outsourced that to the community and said, you know, we think there's some people who would do that for free. And then the community, by building reputation, would essentially select the best ones, and we'd achieve the same end. We'd have great editorial commentary about the books and things, and it didn't cost us anything, and yet we got the best ones self-selected by the community.
And so you get into the bottom, the middle one there, which is around collaboration. You know, once you have this structure where people can understand who other people are and whether they can trust them or not, both at a local level because you know them because they're family, or at a global level because you know, because you've seen they've done other good work that's been good and you've been able to vote about it, then you start to support this very rich collaboration model. Another example, actually, which is quite interesting, was I went to a talk by the Xbox Live people. And now if you go and have a look at Xbox Live, apparently, I'm not a big gamer, but apparently what happens in the game space is that kids come on and they just scream abuse. And now you have the ability to vote people down. So if people just scream abuse, and they end up in these, they've got these four or five different levels, And people who just want to scream abuse end up all in one level, and people who don't end up in other levels. So you have this ability to voting, and say that then gives you a much richer collaboration system. So the people that you've voted into your level, you can then start to interact with and start to have discussions with, which gives you this very rich collaborative structure where you can actually start to say, well, actually, these people are the people I respect, and how can I work with them? I can perhaps have an RSS feed about what they're doing, look at their blogs and so on and so forth. So that's the collaboration side. We talked already about the content, moving from very basic content up into much more advanced content in terms of video and movie. And then the final thing is discovery. And discovery is an interesting one because we're very familiar with the search engines. But to a great extent, the search engines are beginning to struggle because people do so much Google-loving to try and make sure that they come up high in the Google ratings that the engines are getting less and less good at providing the right sort of content. So what we're seeing people start to say, well, I'm going to tag this. And we're beginning to see this whole element tagging and tag clouds and how do you find stuff? Because, you know what, I have people that I respect. They're in my list of people that I know are interested in the same things. They tag this information, and I use the knowledge I have about them plus their knowledge in terms of the tags they've built to actually allow me to find the stuff I want. So we have this explosion of content, and the content in many cases is rich, so you can't actually go and search it with an engine. You can't search a video with an engine. It doesn't work, right?
Right, yeah. That's tough, yeah.
So you actually do have to tag it anyway, just to be able to find it. Again, your podcast, how does somebody find a podcast? They can't.
This is I'm thinking I've got to go ask the guys at Channel 9 for this because I can tag an episode of ArtCast, but I can only tag it with one tag. And I have to tag it the very first time I upload it. And so I just tag everything with the architecture tag, because it kind of everything falls into that. But ideally, somebody who's listening to this could create a tag and say Web 2.0 and add that tag, and if other people agreed, maybe it would stay, maybe it would go. I don't know how that would work, but I mean, because one of the things I try to do is in the links for this episode, I'll try to relate it to other episodes that are similar, but that's just out of my brain, but it would be great if the world who listened to this could help me out with that.
And in fact, there's a website out there called Delicious, which does exactly that. Mm-hmm. And what Delicious does is it allows you to have, you can go and you can find all the different podcasts and you can tag them so you can find them quickly. But those tags are then available globally, right? And so everybody can then go and tag them. So other people can put different tags on and the tags then build together and you can start to search, depending on the number of tags that have been associated with a particular piece of information. And then you can start to say, well, actually, how do I see... what the most important tags are, and you have this concept of tag clouds. And tag clouds are where you put the name of the tag up in larger letters, in a larger font, so that you can see, okay, there's all this space, and you can see some things are bigger than others, and it starts to give you this ability to navigate through this much more complex space rather than you get with a fairly simple search engine. Again, very, very active space. Delicious was just bought by Yahoo. Just recently, about 2 months ago. And Delicious was certainly the leading company in this space, but Delicious does provide this ability to go and tag anything anywhere.
What's interesting about that is that typically, in our kind of Web 1.0 thinking, we would say, well, obviously we've got to come up with a taxonomy of tags, and so we'll have a big meeting and get some people together and come up with this thing because we want to be highly efficient, and we say, well, if we allow anybody to create any old tag they want, there'll be kind of weird duplicates or things that are close but not exactly the same. But in the Web 2.0 thinking, you say, no, the world will sort that out on its own.
And that's exactly right. That's exactly how it's seen. The idea is you put something out there. It may not be optimum or whatever, but just by sheer numbers, eventually we'll crack the problem. And that's what we see. And the successful Web 2.0 companies are ones that try not to answer all the questions. Something very difficult for Microsoft, because we're very typically build all the features in there. We're a very much a features type of company. But that's not the way these things work. The way these new applications work is, let's put something rough and ready out there. Let's put it out in beta. Let's just let's just go and see what people use, and then we will update those elements that people use and leave the other ones to atrophy and die. So exactly, that's exactly right. You know, you will see that sort of activity going on. So what this is about, what this slide is about, is actually how does all this lot tie together. I've talked about all sorts of things. I've talked about service-oriented architecture. I've talked about Web 2.0, a little bit about composition. I've talked about relationship management, content, collaboration, and discovery. This actually shows how it all ties together, and this is actually a formative graph, diagram. And it's something that we're working on, and this is what Edge is about. And the idea here is that on the bottom, in the blue box, we have the enterprise providing some sort of service-oriented architecture. And that will continue. And down at the bottom, I have a graduation. It shows that we will have the ability to have a single server, and we will also have, you know, a global server, which are these big software as a service platforms. And we'll see more and more growth in these big global platforms at the back end. Up in the top end, you've got the whole Web 2.0 space. And again, at the moment, we start off with single user and applications. We're getting into connected applications and these mashup applications. As we move forward, actually, we'll start to see these global applications. And I've talked a little bit about mashups and application composition, but you can actually see how that gets much more dynamic. And certainly when you start to get into the sort of peer-to-peer space, we're familiar, obviously, with things like Groove and Xbox. Xbox Live, for instance, is a very, very classic example of a pure P2P application. Xbox Live, all it ever does with the back-end service is it just validates. I mean, all it's actually using is the relationship management. You know, am I part of this game or not? On what level am I with this game? And it just validates against the back-end, and then the boxes themselves communicate through the internet directly from one to the other. So it's a very strongly a peer-to-peer application. Skype is another one. I mean, Skype doesn't have any back-end servers. All the routing is done on your desktop. So, you know, when you fire up Skype and start to use Skype on your laptop or your desktop, it's actually using your desktop to do a lot of its routing. It doesn't have any servers.
Well, you know, that's an incredibly powerful idea, right? Because if you build the infrastructure to rely on back-end servers to carry the majority of the load, then you are just signing up for a lot of expense, a lot of headaches, because the back-end has to scale to global level. It's just going to be very, very difficult.
No, that's exactly right. So whilst there are times when you want that hugely reliable back-end, if you're doing your banking, for instance, there are times when you say, well, actually, I'm quite happy to do this through a massive cloud of people. It may be, you know, doing the SETI-type stuff to try and find new life or doing cancer research or whatever. There are a large number of applications out there which can be spread across across this whole very large number of devices. Where Web 2.0 is a step on that way, it's definitely, you know, it's not definitely not at the full end of the peer-to-peer spectrum, because in many cases we don't have the underlying technology to support that, but that's certainly where that's going. So what you're seeing on the back end there is you're seeing, if you go back one second, because I haven't finished on that slide actually.
Okay.
So what you're seeing down in the service-oriented space is you're seeing this, okay, how do we build these global platforms? And Microsoft is, you know, as I said, is very focused on building some very large global-scale platforms to underpin everything. So you can just drop all your... If you want to do email, just drop it onto this platform, right? And Microsoft takes care of it. If you want to do Salesforce, sales-type activities, you just drop it on this back-end platform. So that's one end of things. In the client side of things, we're not there yet, but we will see the ability to have an operating system which can not only communicate with the back-end systems, but can communicate to other systems, to other front-end systems as well. And so we get very much into a grid-type environment. And, you know, we will see a dramatic growth in the interest around the whole area of grid. Now, not grid for high-performance computing, because that's a very specialist application, but grid in order to do, you know, voice over IP, grid in order to do gaming, grid in order, you know, there will be a lot of different activities going on which can be done with these grid-type architectures in the front end. And then finally, what you'll hear a lot from Microsoft about in the next 6 or 9 months is the whole area of composition. That is, okay, so we've got these two underlying platforms. How do we actually build applications on those? And it's effectively mashups. How do we very simply take different applications and tie them together? And there's two elements to this. First of all is the application composition. Which is actually how you just literally tie Google Maps and eBay together through an API, which actually isn't too much of a problem, to be honest. It's a pretty simple thing to do. And the second side of things is the whole area of data composition, and that is, if I've got two webcasts, how do I, two podcasts, how do I tie those together? It doesn't really, it becomes much more difficult. You have to understand things about the data shape, the data, the properties of the data, how you tie those data elements together, how do you cut a piece of data up. So to give you an example, again, coming back into podcasting, you could say, well, I've just got a single podcast, and I'll tag that single podcast. But what you could do is you could split the podcast up into single elements, and you could tag each element. And then what you could do is you could say, well, actually, what I want to do now is I want to build a new type of podcast, a composite podcast, which pulls these elements together and gives a talk, which is actually structured in a different way. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's around data composition. And right. I think that's much more interesting, and I think it's a much more challenging technical problem. But I'm just putting here that together as composition. Say Microsoft's going to be talking much more heavily about composition in the next year or so. To start off, we'll be talking about application composition. But I believe personally that the more interesting and the more difficult area will be data composition, and I think that very quickly people will start to look at data schema and what does a data schema and a metadata look like when we want to be able to do data composition. And then over the top of all this, we've already talked about these four areas that we use in order to actually to tie these two ends together, the relationships, the content itself, the collaboration and the discovery, how those things are then layered over this underlying platform.
Okay, So the relationship management, I love this. You have tribes and what?
Folksonomies, that is.
Oh, okay, folksonomies, okay.
These are, again, we're talking a little bit. I mean, we start off with, basic security, then into identity management. I've covered these things, I think, to a great extent. We have friends, family, and group management. Then you have access management. Okay, so you only want particular elements, friends to access particular data or particular applications. I've got an application that I only want myself and my friends or my group to use. And then once you've got this information, you can actually start to think, well, okay, if I know who's coming into to use my application or my data, I can personalize that information. Now, we understand that with portals today, web parts have been around for a long while. You can personalize your own system quite easily. But what you can now do is you can say, well, actually, when my wife wants to come and have a look at my bank account, I can actually personalize both the view she has and the data she gets, because she's coming through using my access rights. Do you see what I mean? So we start to be able to personalize things, and then we get to the point up the top end here where we have tribes and folksonomies. And this is where we say, okay, we've actually now got an external group of people that we work with. They're our hobby group or whatever. And we understand what other things they're interested in, what they want to do with it, and how we can vote effectively. This gets into this whole area of voting, how we can increase our understanding of the trust level that we're going to give them and bind those together. So let's give a concrete example of that. It's possible, and I've actually written a program to do it, to go away and say, okay, I want a program that finds all the people that are really, really hot in podcasting. It's a new area. How do we find today who's the best, in a sport? Well, what we do today, of course, is you go in competitions and eventually again the Olympics and everybody knows them. But there are more and more people in the world. It gets more and more difficult. Obviously the top 2% or 1% or 0.01% will find. But say you want to find the other people in your area who are your sort of level you want to compete with. How do you actually go about doing that? Or say you want to find the people in your area who are really expert in architecture. How do you go and go about that? Well, what you can do is you can say people actually are using the web and they start to leave breadcrumbs. They start to use footprints in the web. So to give you an example, say I want to find somebody who's the best person on online learning. What I can do is I could say, well, this person's likely to be going and talking at conferences. So I go and find a speaker list for a conference, and then I find the associations from that person, the relationships they have with other groups, with other conferences, and I track along that graph, and I find the other conferences they speak at, and I get a list of all the people at that conference, and I pull those people down, And I go, and then I go around from those conferences, and I then build up this massive graph of people and places that those people go to. And I can then filter that graph and say, who's the person that's spoken at most conferences and written most white papers and has been most active in the blogs? Because they're likely to be the best person in space. You can write a very simple program to do that today, because I did it. And it goes around, and you can point it, and you can say, well, actually, you know, I want to know who's the best in, I don't know, cooking. And it will go and search off cooking sites, and it will come back, and it will say, this is actually the person who's got the highest ranking, the highest rating. Okay, and this is, by the way, the space they fit inside, and it will give you the whole space back. Immensely powerful. And I, as I said, I actually tried it in a space I knew nothing about, which was learning. And I tested it with some people who are good in learning. I said, is this the best person in learning? I said, wow, how did you know that? You know?
But, of course, this depends on the the sites that have this information, the conference sites and whatnot, publishing RSS feeds and things that you can consume, doesn't it?
No, not at all. This actually just worked with Google.
Oh, okay.
You go out with Google, and Google, I mean, Google's got an API.
Okay.
Okay, so what it actually did was it programmatically drove Google.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay, interesting. Now, one thing that hits me about identity management, when I think about the kind of sites that allow this stuff today, the identity management is the one thing that, you know, kind of like whether it's Yahoo or Google or MySpace or whatever, all these guys, they require you to have an identity on their site in order to access their group thing. You know, so if I wanted to say, like, I want to decide what identities I will accept, you know, and I'll accept an identity from this guy or that guy or whatever. There's just, you don't find that today.
No, you're absolutely right. And this comes to an interesting question about where the data's stored. I mean, and the data, we can either think of data being content like a photo, in which case we can store it on our local machine or we can store it up in the cloud on Flickr. Or, you know, our individual or metadata information, like, you know, as you say, our logon information or our password information or a bank account. I mean, I have a file on my machine which has got all my personal information in it, and it's encrypted and so on and so forth. And then, you know, where do you want that saved? Now, ideally, I'd like that saved on my machine, and I'd like it saved somewhere else, because if I lose my machine, that would be a bit awkward, right? And I want to make sure it's secure and all the rest of it. So that whole area is a very, you know, very important, very dynamic area. I think, interestingly enough, Microsoft has a proposal in that area. It's called info cards, and the idea is that you have all your information stored in this info card, and the info card is then stored either, you know, on your machine or up in the cloud somewhere. This is similar to what was happening with Passport, and actually Passport were migrating on into these sort of models as well. I think it's a very sensitive area because people don't want to put their information on other people's systems very much. My personal opinion is that, and I'm not sure quite where we're going with the products on this, but my personal information, my personal feeling is that, yes, you do want to store that personal information, and yes, in some cases, you do want to store it somewhere else as well as on your own local machine. And obviously, you want it encrypted and safe and all the rest of it. But I think any model which says it's got to be on our machine, or it's got to be on your machine, or it's got to be on their machine, or whatever, is bound to fail, because people will want different things for different, you know, for different uses. And I think that what we'll see is we'll see the ability for you to tag your information, your personal information. And you'll say, you know, this piece of personal information, I want to be held here, and I don't want it to be available to anybody else. This piece of information, maybe it's my social security number. Okay, I only want it to be available to me and my bank and the IRS or one or two other areas, you know. So we'll actually end up with this much richer way of providing information, because nobody wants just to be able to provide all information to everybody. The info cards certainly provide the ability to do that on an application-by-application basis, but you'll also say where you want to store the information. I built a system a while back, back in the UK, which actually allowed you to say which particular technologies you were interested in. You gave that information to Microsoft, and Microsoft would then give you the right feeds for that information. And it worked well. But it was wrongly architected, because when I went away and thought about it afterwards, I realized that Microsoft was storing the information that somebody was interested in SQL Server and they were interested in Exchange. And really what we should have done is we should have put that on the machine itself, on their machine, and they should have held that information because it was part of their personal information. And we should have queried that, okay, and got back the pieces we needed and not ever saved that and used that for the switching mechanism. So again, when you architect things, in particular in this space, we tend to think of, oh, it'd be really nice to centralize everything. People don't want that. We had a project called Hailstorm, which you're probably familiar with, which died to death because this was exactly the mistake they made. The mistake they made, it wasn't wrong or any of those things. The problem they had was they didn't take in the social element, that people did not want to store all their personal information in Microsoft. And I think we've learned that lesson well, and I think we need a much richer model, and identity cards is one element of that. I don't think we've got to the end of that, but we certainly, when we're architecting things around that space, we need to be very, very careful that we factor in the social element.
But I think there's business drivers about why all these places force me to join their site to participate in their thing, you know, because they want to be able to say to their advertisers, oh, look, we have X million members on our site. And if they didn't require that, you know, it'd be much harder for them to sustain their business model, I think.
I totally agree. And I think one of the, you know, the problems with a lot of these things is people do this. They want a lot more information than they necessarily require because than they need, simply because they like to acquire information. It's a value to them as well. And we're certainly seeing the case where, yes, you know, you can give your information away, but when you do that, you get something back in return for it. Rather than, I don't have a problem if somebody comes to me and says, you know, I want your name and address to send me something. Yeah, I think, you know, I don't have a problem with that. If they say, I want other information, demographic information about you, and you don't need it, then why should I give it? Because it's a value, right? So they should pay me for that, and we're beginning to see that. You know, you say, well, you give us information, you fill in the survey, and you'll get a free iPod or whatever. And you're beginning to see that. People are beginning to say, you know what? This whole business about we'll just put a whole load of questions in there and hope that the people are stupid enough to fill them in without getting paid for it will go away, because people, I think, will become much more aware of the value of their personal information and start to charge for it.
That's like, you know, you buy a new washing machine and the warranty registration card asks you, you know, serial number and model number and stuff like that, which makes sense. And then they start asking, like, how much money do you make and how many children do you have? You know, and stuff like that is crazy.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You know, that's not going to happen, right? I mean, people are beginning to be aware that their personal information is much more valuable and they'll charge for it. So this is then looking at some of those more detailed areas, and I think we've covered those. We've got the area of content, and I talked about we went from image through audio, geographic information, which is where we see the hot areas are with mapping. And we're going into video from that, and then into TV, and then finally into movies. And I talked a little bit about the machinima space and what's happening in that. So we're seeing, you know, over time, as the bandwidth goes up, we're seeing more and more the content getting richer and richer. And I fully expect in 2 years' time, you know, there to be a Ron's TV show. You know?
Well, you know, I've already made some video, kind of been experimenting with video versions of this show, and we're definitely going to do more of those. So, I mean, yeah, I think that's going to happen. As it becomes more practical to do it, there's a lot of obstacles around dealing with these very large, rich contents today, but it's getting better all the time.
And then that feeds into this whole area of collaboration. And I think one of the ones that I want to pull out in this is Wikipedia. I think we're all familiar with Wikipedia and the concept here, and that is, you know, people have a very simple page. It's a wiki page. Actually, a wiki is an awful lot. Just as a comment here, I have a Land Rover, and it broke the other day. And I didn't know what was the matter with it, and the garage were giving me the usual flim-flam that garages give you. So I wasn't sure if they were telling me the truth or not. And they said it needed a new computer, and the computer was like $1,500. So I went and had a look in the Range Rover manuals, which I Googled, and you could find the Land Rover manuals out there. And I went through them, and they weren't very clear. And then I actually Googled a bit further, and I found there was a guy who had a Land Rover wiki. And he'd put up this wiki about Land Rovers, and people had put stuff in there, and there was a guy who'd actually put in how to fix this computer in there. And you could go and have a look at it, and when you actually read through what he'd done, you realized there wasn't anything wrong with my car. It was actually the door catch that was broken, not the computer. And I went back to the garage, and I said, you know, it's actually the door catch that's broken, not the computer. And they said, well, that's not what it says in the manuals. And I said, no, the manuals are wrong. If you go and look at the wiki page, that wiki page saved me, you know, $1,500. So they're very, very powerful because they start to pull information together from people that are really doing these things. And Wikipedia is a case in point. Wikipedia is 10 times bigger than Encyclopedia Britannica. It's growing much, much faster than Encyclopedia Britannica is. And the question then is, what's the quality of the content? And that's what people always say, you know, okay, so anybody can go and update this thing. It could be have any old rubbish in there. And then there was a very classic case last year where there was somebody put something out which was about Kennedy assassination, which was incorrect and was slanderous, I think, against somebody. And it was taken down, in fact, but there was a big fuss about it in the papers. A couple of points from that. First of all, interestingly enough, they actually found the guy. I mean, you know, you think that you could go and change things in the web and nobody can tell. It's not true. You leave a fingerprint out there, and I think we will learn that these things, they look as though you can't be traced, you can be traced. The second was that Nature then did a survey to say, well, how good is the quality of the information? And they found that Wikipedia, in every article that they tested, Wikipedia had like about 4 mistakes in that article, in average, right? The interesting thing is that when they benched that against Encyclopedia Britannica, Britannica had 3 mistakes in every article, so it wasn't wildly different. And the thing was that the mistakes were much more quickly fixed in Wikipedia than they ever were in Britannica. So, you know, this whole collaborative element, building content and pulling information together, is shown very clearly in Wikipedia. And I think it's a very powerful model, and we'll see a lot more of it. We see things like that. We talked a little bit about the robots, the bot technology, the ability at conferencing to do back channeling. Again, something that's very hot at the moment is where if you go to a conference, there's all these people with their laptops in the back. Why don't we just give them an instant message format so that they can talk to one another? In the conference itself and ask questions, you know, because there'll be people in the, if you don't understand something, there'll be somebody in the audience who understands it and can explain it to you. And this is called back channeling. We tried it a couple of times. We tried it at Tech Ready. There weren't enough people, I don't think, you know, and it's a very new technology. But, again, an interesting idea. And you can then start to have somebody who's moderating the questions in the conference, and you start to have a very much more dynamic conference experience than there is today. So,
as a conference speaker, I think that would be pretty useful, right? I mean, if there was suddenly a whole bunch of stuff going on the back channel, like, what did he just say? I didn't get that. It'd be great if, you know, you could even have the moderator stand up and go, excuse me, we didn't get that.
No, and we see that. And you know, whilst it actually puts a lot of pressure on the presenter, again, speaking as presenters, and I know presenters who've actually put the back channel up on the monitor, you know, so they have 2 monitors, one their presentation, one the back channel. And it puts a lot of pressure on the presenter because there'll be people in the audience who are experts. You know, and if you say something's wrong, they'll come back. And they'll say, in fact, I actually saw that. I saw, somebody, the Microsoft presenter, say something, which I thought at the time, I don't think that's correct. And somebody on the back channel said, that's not correct. And they actually had written the spec in this space. It was one of those awful moments. The guy in the audience really did know it. And it means that you're much more careful, a presenter, to make sure that you're more accurate, which I think is good for everybody. I think it's obviously quite exciting for the presenter when you're actually doing it. But
okay, so you know what? We're having so much fun here. We're getting way behind.
But I think we've covered most of these, so we just go on. So what we can say here is that, you know, we've now got these elements: relationship management, content, collaboration, discovery. They're all things that happen in, we can see a lot more dynamism in the Web 2.0 space, but will actually fold back. You can see how all of those things are going to affect the big enterprise space and service-oriented architecture. And down at the bottom there, we have the connected systems, you know, the areas we look at in connected systems for a service-oriented architecture: federated data, identity and access management. And you can see how the things that we're seeing in the Web 2 space and in the community space, we can see how those map onto the services underneath. And again, we'll see those services become much more rich and flexible as time goes on. And certainly a lot of this stuff is where Microsoft is looking to go in terms of, its live support, what's happening with the live platform, the platform themselves, what we're going to be doing in terms of tool support, developer support, and so on and so forth. So this affects all sorts of different areas. And there are obviously certain patterns that are associated with what's going on. And we've talked about many of these, you know, Napster and Skype as peer-to-peer models and asynchronous models and so on and so forth. So there's sets of patterns that are associated with what's going on out there.
And And of course, there are some major players that we talked about that we think that, you know, we're hoping we'll be one of them, of course, right?
But so some of these people are worth watching. Yahoo, in my opinion, everybody talks about Google. I don't think Google's doing a lot of activity. I'm not sure they have a huge amount of strategy. If you go and have a look at the people who have the best strategy in this space, without a doubt, is Yahoo. Yahoo are doing some very smart acquisitions. Flickr and Delicious are two of the obvious ones. They clearly understand this space well, and they're doing a good job. eBay, again, I would put up there, and Amazon, again, have strategies. They're not as comprehensive as Yahoo. I've put in there what Microsoft, you know, some of our products areas and some of the things we're doing. So there's the whole live space, there's live local gadgets, which are these elements that you can put into your browser. MSN spaces we've talked about, and they're well understood. We have, I can't remember now, the numbers of people in, it's 70 million, I think, MSN spaces out there now, some huge number. And, of course, that means that we have a huge connectivity to very large numbers of people, and that's obviously very, very valuable. Hotmail as well, of course, sits in there. There's the whole area of instant messaging, MSN8's coming out, and that will have this much more advanced robots put into them. Fremont, again, was announced with a funny name, which I can't remember. Fremont was our version of Craigslist, and that was its beta name, and it's just come out as something like Live Market or something like that.
Which, oh, again, right, yeah.
Was announced yesterday. Foldershare was an acquisition we made, again, to do a sort of, and we'll get into the ability to provide back-end folders so you can store your data wherever you like. So our strategy in this area is, you know, there's a lot of acquisitions we're going on buying small companies, and then building out in under the Live brand to provide a lot of this functionality. And it will provide the functionality both in terms of a lot of the application types, but we'll also provide the functionality in terms of platform at the back end, platform at the front end, and then some of these applications sitting on top of them. There's a thing called Live Labs, which is going out and trying to build many of these composite application types out there today, and so we'll see a lot more this whole composition and compositing applications going on top of this underlying platform.
Okay, in the last minute or so here, what's the call to action?
Well, you know, I think when we work inside enterprises and with big companies, we see a lot of what's going on in there, and we work on a lot of the management and deployment aspects and so on and so forth, the service-oriented architecture. And I think it's very easy to lose sight of things that are going on outside. So do keep an eye on what's happening with in the consumer space. It will drive a lot of what's going to be happening in the future. So, you know, keep a close eye on that. Keep a close eye on the live announcements. They will give you an indication of where we're going. And monitor those areas, because in many cases you could be working a customer. I went to a big motor manufacturer, for instance, who's looking at building Web 2.0 type application front ends for selling their cars. So, you know, there's a lot of big companies are beginning to say, well, how can we use this stuff? I know of one travel company, for instance, doing a similar sort of thing. How can we use this stuff to actually go and build better applications for our customers? So be aware that these things are happening and start to factor some of those back into the designs you see. And then talk to people about what's going on. We're actually doing that. We have an event called Mix, which is very much around how you do web development in the Web 2.0 space. We're actually going to have a pre-conference to that called Spark, which is an invitation only. We've got about 30 people coming who are looking at what the architectural implications are of what we're seeing and how we pull that together. Go out and, again, see what's happening in terms of the patterns that you can see in these application types. And, you know, I think it's important that we as a company and the individuals that work for the company, the MVPs in particular, seem to be thought leaders in these spaces. You know, I think it's important that we see what's happening in the consumer space, feed that back into the enterprise space. And my ambition is for everybody who's, you know, working for or with Microsoft is seen to be the people that are leading the understanding and the thought and the thinking in application development.
Okay, and you know what? So I will be there at Spark, and we'll be doing ArtCast from there. So we're going to be talking to some of those great thinkers who are going to be there, bringing that to our listeners. So I want to thank Mike Platt for being with me today. Thank you so much. And we'll see you guys next time on ArtCast.
Mike Platt, ladies and gentlemen, on Web 2.0. Yeah, in just a few hours at 3:30 in the morning, I will roll out of bed with a huge headache, grab my bags, hand them to the shuttle driver, and go to the airport, where I will then depart for the Spark Conference in Las Vegas, to be followed by the Mix Conference in Las Vegas. And then on Tuesday, I'll hop on a flight to Wales in the UK, where I'll be attending the Architecture Insight Conference. And then the next week, I'll be in Boston for the Patterns and Practices Summit. Wow, I mean, I am going to be conferenced out. But good news, because I'm going to be talking to many, many interesting guests while I'm out traveling the world. And I'll be bringing you the latest information from all these events here on ArtCast.